Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Out of 50 years on the road in a legendary rock and roll outfit, what have you learned?
To relax. And it's a lot easier these days than it was in the beginning because we're blessed with the very helpful nature of tour planning with Mr. Google and British Airways website and a whole bunch of other tools that make putting tours together and then actually executing them a whole lot less stressful than I seem to remember it was back in the 70s when, you know, you weren't really quite sure what you were doing on any one day. It was all a bit of an adventure, but these days you can plan something and be reasonably sure, apart from the security queues at the airport, how the day is going to progress. So, by and large, it's a lot easier, and I think you can make it easier still by just learning to conserve your energy and your, you know, reduce stress levels. The time when you need to really be switched on and focused is 2 minutes before you walk on stage, and that's really the key to it, is timing everything so you get to that moment and you are 100% ready for it, and then afterwards you can return to your slug-like, rather boring, anything but rock and roll state of mind
and
body.
Yeah, I'm sure when you were your van broke down in 1971, Siri and your iPhone could have been very helpful at that time, you know.
I think all the things that we take for granted today, and perhaps a generation of young people have never really known anything different. But
yeah,
given that I suppose the internet kicked in meaningfully in the late 90s in terms of offering us the search engines and the information bases that we could access, so a lot of people, you know, born perhaps in the mid 90s onwards, you know, they've never really known anything other than that.
Yeah.
Even my children grew up, I suppose, at the age of 3 or 4 with the earliest of computers, and so perhaps all of their childhood and all of their adult lives, certainly they've been able to take for granted all of those benefits. And the frightening thing is, if they suddenly disappear, if that president from your southern border suddenly gets it into his head to really irritate Mr. Putin, then you know, things could just get shut down overnight.
And
it sure can. It's in these days of cyber warfare and the potential for causing major mayhem and upheaval, I think it would hurt people perhaps almost more in the sense of robbing them of access to mobile phones or the internet or the power grid.
Yeah.
You know, where would we be without electricity? We'd all be unplugged. You'd have to have acute hearing, and I would have to try and play my little guitar that little bit louder.
Well, that brings me to the string quartet question, because obviously 50 years on tour on the road, but you've also recently even been releasing music this whole time. About a year ago, the String Quartets was a release, which I'm assuming is a Jethro Tull album done with Jethro Tull music in string quartet form. I guess from a musician's point of view, Ian, what is the hardest part in transferring your classic Tull music into a different genre like a string quartet?
Well, some of the pieces on that string quartet album already had some association with string sections, with a chamber orchestra, perhaps, who were part of the original recording. Others, of course, had nothing like that at all. And so I think what you've got to do is strip things back to the essential musical components of rhythm, of harmony, of melody. Obviously, being an instrumental album, well, almost all an instrumental mm-hmm. album, then there's not much in the way of lyrics. But I think you're forced to think of things in their very fundamental way, and I rather hope that people, when they listen to the String Quartet album, that they recognize old friends just wearing a radically different suit of clothes.
Right.
And it's I think that's part of the fun, really, is to recognize the essential musicality of different pieces and you know, dispense with maybe the preconceptions you have from listening to the rock band version.
Right.
But it was never really designed to be a mega hit album, you know, some that everybody would, you know, fall over themselves to want to buy. It was, you know, very much going to be an acquired taste for a relatively small part of our fan base, but it did shoot to number one in the Billboard Classical Album charts. So I suppose it did reach the spot in the sense of making its mark, and it's something to tick off. You know, one of those things I had in mind to do, and finally got round to doing last year. Well, actually, the end of the year before, but it was released last year. So it's you know, one of the little projects that you have, a side project somewhere that you think, well, it'd be nice to do that before I get too old to string quartet.
Yeah. So how long did you have it in your head?
Well, probably a couple of years, right. and then John O'Hara, our keyboard player, and I sat down to discuss possible songs, possible treatments, and we had a few meetings while we were on tour, sitting in dressing rooms, sitting in hotel lobbies, and going through ideas, and then I looked for a suitable a quartet who had the musical ability, but also the geographical availability and the temporal availability. They had to be free at a certain time when we could possibly work together, and they had to be not too far away. So some ideas I had about maybe using one of the quartets I've worked with in the past in the Czech Republic, you know, a little bit too far to go when you can find a group of people who live 40 minutes down the road from, well, between John O'Hara and myself, in fact. So it was quite an easy geographical mix to find those guys and girls.
Yeah, that helps getting it done, too.
They were truly a, you know, world-class string quartet, great, great musicians.
Yeah. Jethro Tull pioneered a lot of different things in music, and you mentioned some of the orchestra work that you did. But the most recognizable, obviously, is the flute. And you made that happen. Like, you made the flute rock, Ian. Have you ever witnessed a band try and incorporate an instrument that just didn't work out? Because I play the bagpipes, and let me tell you, I am looking for a shot.
Well, you've kind of missed the boat, really. I think I've used bagpipes, used the pipes on two songs in my life that I recall. And, you know, it's one of those difficult things to, well, apart from anything else, as you probably know, the most common tuning for the pipes is somewhere between an A and a B flat, and it's not really an instrument that fits in with the rest of the musical world. But you can get a chanter that's tuned perhaps to an A.
And then, takes a lot of jigging, but
and then you've got to obviously tune your drones accordingly, but a lot of pipers seemingly don't like to do that. They like the traditional Scottish tuning, which is a halfway house, and really, unfortunately, if you have a perfect pitch, then the pipes are going to sound excruciatingly flat to you.
Yeah.
And therein lies a bit of a problem. But
we for sure are in our own little bubble. I can tell you that.
Definitely are. And usually you're only in the context of drummers.
Yeah.
So I think pipe bands probably have the same drummer jokes as rock bands do.
yeah.
But you're missing out because you've got no bass player jokes.
That's true. Yeah. We have one bass and it's a bass drum even.
Okay.
I've been playing the bagpipe since I was 8 or 9 years old. I was kind of a childhood prodigy, but you weren't a childhood prodigy at the flute, though, were you? Like, at what age did you actually start on the flute?
Well, I had to reconsider that just today because a track, an old, well, two old studio tracks that were that were discovered in the months before Jethro Tull began. We'd made some demos for a producer in London, and nothing happened to them, but we recorded a couple of pieces which kind of surfaced in a not very good copy of a copy form, but the gist of it is there. So they were going to be included as bonus tracks on the remixed and revitalized original Jethro Tull album, This Was, which is being released this October to celebrate the 50th anniversary of its original release. Mm-hmm. One day out. These days they tend to release on a Friday. So that's coming out along with the tracks which I had to listen to today, and I was reminded that there seems to be in the background a flute being played. Mm-hmm. And so I was asked the question by the record company, so you actually were playing the flute in the latter months, summer, or September or something of 1967, and I said, no, I really don't think so. I seem to remember the first note I ever got out of a flute was in December of 1967, and really 4 or 5 weeks later, I was playing it on stage every night and from a standing start. So I'm positive it's not me. So it turns out there's also on the tape box, apparently, there is also an oboe as well as a flute. So there's almost certainly some session people that the producer brought in to decorate these songs a little bit after we'd recorded our band version of them. So I'm confident that it was December 67, and I was 20 years old, and it was really just translating what I had played on electric guitar a year or two before when I was a guitarist, translating that into my earliest attempts to play the flute. So I couldn't really play a pure note. I sang the note as well to reinforce the note, and I developed that style of trying to make a more forceful, aggressive sound, which I suppose from January onwards people were noticing, and it set us apart from the other blues bands at the Marquee Club, like Savoy Brown and Chicken Shack and the early Fleetwood Mac. We were the band that had the guy who played the flute.
Right. And I know a lot of pro guitar players, often they can't stop buying guitars. Do you have a massive collection of flutes?
Not really, no. I have probably, out of the flutes that I play, that I would consider my top line flutes, I have two of those.
Right.
And then I have a couple of backup flutes that are kind of student model flutes that one of which I will always take with me on the road in case my main, rather better quality flute should, for some reason, suffer illness. Then I have a backup.
Right.
Okay. One of my backup flutes from a few years before did leave my side and managed to travel close on a million miles because it was in orbit around planet Earth on the International Space Station for 6 months, and it came back to me in three pieces just as it left. Three pieces, because you take a flute apart into three pieces to put it in the case, and mine was smuggled aboard a Russian rocket, cargo supply rocket, that took it up to the space station, and it came back on the second last ever space shuttle mission, and made it safely home, and it's carefully locked up in a room in my house to this day. But I'm not someone who collects things really for the sake of collecting them. I like to use them, and I periodically sell things off if I'm really not going to use them again. I don't see the point in amassing piles of stuff. I mean, unfortunately, I say that, but like everybody, I do amass piles of stuff, and it's a good plan, particularly with things that quickly become redundant.
Yes.
I have an iPhone 4, 5, 6, and 10, and of course, anyone I use is the 10. What am I going to do with the others? I just feel guilty about you know, putting them into a landfill site. And you always have that feeling, maybe just one day I want to use them again.
I'll do something with them. Maybe there's something important on them that I forgot to remove or transfer the data over or something.
Well, yes, and the fond thought that you might donate them to an excited grandchild, forget it. Yeah. Because if you tried palming off an iPhone 4 or 5 on a grandchild, they're going to look at it and say, I want the 10.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't have the facial recognition or whatever.
You need to go to school with an iPhone 4, do you? I'd be the laughing stock of my class. Not that my grandchildren are perhaps quite old enough to use the term laughing stock, but, you know.
Yeah, of course.
They are fairly small.
Well, the 50th anniversary tour hits Toronto Bud Stage July the 3rd. Jethro Tull, it's incredible, the lasting influence on future generations of musicians that you have had. I'm sure there's a lot of fans out there who are also pretty famous in their own right. Have you ever been approached by a celebrity with some praise or surprised by a fellow musician's fanship that you weren't aware of?
Yeah, you will actually see three of them will pop up on the big screen behind me who revealed a secret love for some of Jethro Tull's work. So yes, they are amongst my pop-up guests on the big video screen, and of course it's very flattering to hear that, but you've got to remember, you've got to be logical about it. None of us just have one or two influences. We sat and wrote the names down, there'd be at least 50. So yeah. In that context, I am but one of many influences that, you know, some given household name, rock god, happens to consider of some modest part in his or her own musical upbringing. But, you know, it's nice to hear. And what I'm really doing on this tour, really celebrating not only the repertoire of Jethro Tull, but celebrating the 36 other band members who've been over the years with me. And
that's true. There's a large list.
There certainly is. And four of them are on stage with me, of course. But the it is a long list. And I rather like to try and give them all some little reference points. So at one time or another, you'll catch a glimpse of all of them, and that's kind of a nice thing. They're traveling around the world with me, but I'm not having to pay for hotel rooms or catering.
Yeah, that's a large group to drag around with you.
Yes, it's a large virtual group.
What happens when we play outside? We become healthier, both mentally and physically. We become more creative and more focused. We connect with nature, each other, and ourselves. Let's Take This Outside, a new podcast hosted by me, Marianne Iveson, an aspiring outdoor athlete and nature lover. I speak to athletes, outdoor professionals, and scientists about their connection to nature, how it affects their performance and everyday life. Let's Take This Outside, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and at letstakethisoutside.ca.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.